You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. If you're a regular listener to the Radio Cafe, you might have noticed that we've been doing a number of programs on education. With a new governor in New Mexico and a whole new administration, it feels like there's kind of a sense of hopefulness in the air about education, and some prominent national educators have been visiting New Mexico in recent months. The latest one that I've had a chance to talk to is Terry Holliday, former commissioner of education for the state of Kentucky. We'll be hearing from him in just a moment. The Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation is providing career pathway scholarships for current high school seniors and anyone else who has earned a high school diploma or GED to help fund an associate's degree or professional certification. Residents of seven counties in northern New Mexico may apply at lanlfoundation.org/scholarships, lanlfoundation.org/scholarships. The deadline is May 31st. I'm very happy now to welcome Terry Holliday. He is board chair for the National Professional Teaching Standards Board. He's an advisor to the Council of Chief State Schools Officers, Metametrics, and the State Superintendent of North Carolina. He is former Commissioner of Education for the state of Kentucky. And as you can imagine with that introduction, we're here to talk about education. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's delightful to be back in New Mexico.
Now, you have been talking a lot about taking a systems approach to education. What does that mean? What is a systems approach to education?
Well, I think what we're talking about is you can't make education decisions in isolation of the larger system, the employment of a community, the economy of the community, the healthcare needs of a community, the social needs of a community. You got to think education is just one part of a system. You can't improve education without working with all the other parts of the local system.
And so when we talk about taking a systems approach, are we talking about, a local scale, a state scale, regional, national?
We're talking about all of the above. I've seen systems approach from a national level to the classroom level. You can do a systems approach at any of those levels. And typically, a systems approach is to make sure you know what the customer or the stakeholder of your interest know who they are and know what their expectations are. Like if I'm a grocery store chain, what customers am I trying to meet their needs? And then the leadership of the organization has to develop plans and activities and actions and strategies to meet the needs of the customer. And then you need a data system that measures how well you're doing in meeting those needs. And then you need an improvement system when you're not meeting the needs and you're losing customers. How can we better improve what we're offering in order to retain those customers, attract new ones, and improve the results that we're getting?
Now, you're using a business metaphor, customers. Who are the customers when you talk about education?
Yeah, well, they're multi-level. The number one customer are the students. So many students get turned off to school. Our high schools, for the most part, are very boring for most of our students. We're not offering the types of hands-on learning activities that many of our children really desire. So we're not listening to our primary customer, which is the student. And then we must listen to business and industry, because the community is so reliant on the local economy. What are the workforce needs of the local community? So we need to structure our education programs, our pathways, our career and technical programs to meet the needs of our local community. And then we need to listen to our other customer, which is the colleges. What academic readiness skills do kids need to get into college? And our big new customer that we're not meeting their needs very well is the military. Only 1 out of 10 of high school graduates could even qualify to enter the military. So our national defense is at stake. And then eventually you've got customers like the General Assembly who provides funding and your school board. So customers are multifaceted. It depends on what part of the system you're trying to address.
One of the great systemic changes that's happened in the last sort of 30, 40 years is stagnation of wages, so the people are not earning what they were able to earn in the 1970s and 80s, and inequality to the point where a report came out the other day that says the U.S. is the most unequal of the developed nations. That's part of the system. Do you feel that education can address those problems of wages and inequality? Are they kind of the victim of it? How do you understand all that?
Absolutely. Since 2008, we've increased the economy probably 10 million, 12 million jobs. But none of those jobs went to people with less than a high school or less than a one-year technical degree. High school grads are the great losers in the current economy. So they're having to take two and three jobs in order to meet the economic outcomes that they had previously. Like if you were a furniture worker in North Carolina, you might have been making $50,000, $60,000 a year, but that job went away. There are no furniture jobs left. They got outsourced or they've got industrialized through robotic approaches. So now you're having to work two or three jobs and you're not making the same level that you had made previously, and your family situation is deteriorating rapidly. However, there are plenty of jobs. What needs to happen is that furniture worker, the retraining of many adults across this nation could happen. That is primarily a community college, technical college, but a higher education issue. Also, it's a long-term issue for your K-12 community because we need to get those K-12 kids ready for coding. Cyber security. We need to get them ready to fly drones. So Northern Virginia recently created a drone credential program starting in 11th grade, followed all the way through to the community college and the University of Virginia in cybersecurity to create a program that kids and adults could access. So we need to think about it both in the short term with many adults that we have, but also in the long term with pathways for students in our current K-12 system.
I think one of the problems of inequality is also connected to the fact that because in most states, not New Mexico, but in most states, school systems operate on basically property taxes. And so in wealthier districts, the schools are better. In poor districts, the schools are worse. How do you deal with that?
Many states are studying equity formulas, and New Mexico has recently a lawsuit made some significant changes in the General Assembly this session. Same thing happened in 1989 in Kentucky. Same thing's happening right now in South Carolina. As long as property taxes, the sole or the largest funder of your education systems, you will continue to have huge inequalities in education systems between the haves and the have-nots. You, as long as a parental decision about where to buy a home is driven a lot by how the quality of the education system, which drives up home prices, which drives up property taxes, the system will continue to exacerbate the haves and the have-nots. I don't know what the answer is, but I do know there must be an answer to the funding issues, but it's only going to come through an answer about the local economy. Typically, you've had strong systems back in the 50s and 60s where they had textile mills, they had furniture, they had coal plants. You had strong education systems in these communities. Then the economy went south, lost coal jobs, lost furniture jobs, lost automotive jobs. You look at Flint, Michigan. If you go back to the 50s, Flint, Michigan had a tremendous school system. But today, it's one of the worst in the nation. What happened first? Did the education system go, deep six, or did the economy? Well, I would say it was the economy, because as soon as the local economy changed, then property taxes declined, people moved, they relocated to communities where they felt like there were better systems, and the school system declined because they didn't have that type of leadership in the local community. So, to answer your question, which comes first, improve the local economy or improve the school system? I'm saying it can't be first. It's not chicken or egg. It's both. And the places that have made changes that have really survived in Eastern Kentucky, went after both a new economy locally and the school system to make sure when they did attract new jobs that they had a school system where parents would want to relocate.
One of the things that's interesting is that some places have real teacher shortages, and we see this in a lot of New Mexico. Some places have teacher surpluses. What accounts for those shortages and surpluses, and what's to be done about it when you look at the kind of larger system?
Well, you go back to the same issue. Years ago in Eastern Kentucky, there was a little community that the coal company pretty much owned the whole community. But there were tons of activities for young adults who were young teachers. And so when they were attracted to the community, they never had any trouble filling jobs and positions. As the industry left, though, they no longer had those. Number one, they had no housing that young people could afford. Number two, they had no local activities that young adults would want to engage in. So that's what happens. And then you go into New Mexico, everywhere you have a teacher shortage, there's usually a couple of reasons being. One, I think in New Mexico, I think across this nation and New Mexico, the last 10 years, we've devalued the teaching profession through teacher evaluation systems that we're not measuring the right things, through basically demoralizing teachers by always saying how horrible the public school system is. We have made teaching a profession that no one wants to get in. We've actually de-elevated the teaching profession. So it's kind of a couple of solutions that I'm seeing in communities across the nation. Elevate the profession, support teachers, and make teaching a profession that people want to go into. Provide housing, provide local activities in these rural communities that these teachers could access, and improve, make sure their economy, their jobs for their spouses. So it is not just one silver bullet, it's a multifaceted solution.
One of the examples that everybody seems to be pointing to these days is the nation of Finland, which took a really failing school system and had a national initiative to professionalize the profession of teaching to where it's really competitive, it's really well paid, and the teachers have a great deal of autonomy once they become teachers. Would that model work in the U.S.?
Well, we certainly have had great isolated pockets where that model has worked on a local basis, but we've never really had the number one thing you'd have to do is you have to eliminate a lot of teacher schools of education. States are unable to do that because colleges rely on that tuition from schools of education. They're usually don't have to spend all of the money. They call them a cash cow. The money comes in, they put it in other places. The quality of the candidates in teacher schools of education is much lower than, say, compared to Finland and Singapore, Shanghai, places like that, because most of those kids who have higher academic abilities do not see teaching as a profession that they want to be a part of. They see they could make more in STEM areas, and they go into the science and math schools at those universities. So I think you got to address salaries, you got to address all those fringe benefits of teaching, you got to elevate the teaching profession. But it seems counterintuitive to when you got a teacher shortage to reduce the number of teacher prep programs, but that's exactly what Finland did. They went and Singapore did. They reduced the number of programs, improved the quality of the programs, improved the quality of the candidates, and improved the quality of the outcomes. But that's very difficult to do when you're sitting in a community. I think one superintendent in New Mexico told me he was unable to fill 20 teaching positions last year because he couldn't find the candidates. So you got to look in the meantime at alternative types of approaches, and you got to look to technology to solve some of the problems. But you're not going to solve it if you continue to have open enrollment type of situation with low standards.
One of the things that I heard you talk about was that you'd rather have your kid in a large classroom with a lot of kids in it with a great teacher than in a small classroom with a substandard teacher. And I think back to my fourth grade, which was absolutely the best year of my entire educational life, where I had a big classroom that was sort of like a lot of self-directed study, a lot of hands-on study. The most brilliant teacher I've ever had, Mr. Chappett, if you are still with us, kudos to you. But that is so rare that you find that kind of classroom where the kids are so engaged because they're doing all different kinds of learning and hands-on learning. And I think we talk so much about like budgets and training and so on, but less about what it takes to get kids excited in the classroom.
Yeah, typically, parents, low class size, that's number one top priority for them usually, so they can get the teacher can give personal attention to their child. And I will certainly love that for my children too. The second thing they look at is resources in the classroom, the level of parental involvement in the classroom, and then looking at external types of things like field trips, access to museums, the fine arts, things like that. So typically your parents who are engaged in the schooling process, those are the kind of things they look for. But too often we kind of leave out probably the most essential piece was the quality of the teacher and the quality of the instruction. And typically in an upper middle class community, most teachers can do fairly well with most classrooms. It takes a really special teacher to take a large classroom in a very challenging environment and get great results from those kids. So our schools of education, quite often the kids have their field-based experience, not with the types of kids they're going to face, but they have their field-based experiences with the kids that look like them when they were growing up. And that's not the way the student population for public schools looks these days. It's changed dramatically in 50 years.
So when you look at a systems-based approach and you have to factor in inequality, not only economic inequality, but also racial and racism and that kind of inequality. You look at trauma, you look at substance abuse, all of these things happen in every state. They certainly happen in New Mexico. How do you factor those things into a systems approach to education?
I think the delivery system at, say, your public school, this is where Health and Human Services, your communities and schools, all of the agencies need, where we're having wraparound schools now, that we're calling them now, where they're providing health services in the schools. But a lot of times the conservative community is very concerned about that because you want to be cautious about going too far one direction or the other. But if you have kids coming to school with instances of trauma, their parents are on drugs, they've got an incarcerated parent, they've got mental health issues in the home, the last thing they're going to be able to do is be successful in school. So, and the last thing that's going to happen is the parent take them to the social services that are needed out in the community. So where are the kids? They will probably be at school because they're going to get probably a lunch, a breakfast, and maybe an afternoon snack. You just got to figure out how to provide more wraparound support for the whole family through the school. Just simple things like in Kentucky, the schools provide kids with meal backpacks to take home in the evening and weekends, just to make sure the kids can have food during the weekends. And then they provide health clinics in the schools, things like that. And there are many ways to do this, and they're much more, they're economically feasible to do when the whole community, Health and Human Services, Department of Labor, Corrections, they're all at the table working together. We have created so many walls and barriers that the agencies cannot talk to each other, cannot share data. We're not looking at the child, what's best for the child. We're looking at what's best for the adults and what's best for somebody's perception of privacy. We need to look at the child, what's the child need, provide what the child needs in the setting where the child is.
So when you say wraparound services, you're talking about when a kid goes to school, he or she can get not only education, but also food, medical services, mental health services, and so on campus kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, again, going back to this whole question of systems approach, do you factor in, or can you factor in, when a kid is receiving those kinds of social services and is able to get off a really bad track and get into a successful track despite what's going on at home, what is the economic impact? What is the return on investment investing in that kid when he or she is 8 years old, 12 years old, 15, you know, 20 years afterwards?
Yeah, there have been plenty of research studies show the impact is probably $7 to every dollar invested at a minimum.
Meaning that
the community will recoup in that student's lifetime earnings, lifetime payment of taxes, the purchasing power of that student to buy a car, buy a home, and the reverse, that they access social services quite a bit less as an adult. They're not incarcerated, which is $50,000 a year. So there are tons of research reports that show providing these wraparound services from early childhood all the way through the college level will have a minimum of a $7 to $1 investment payoff.
So then part of the systemic thinking is long-term thinking.
Absolutely.
Is there resistance to long-term thinking?
Absolutely. It's usually called election cycles because typically folks running for office every 2 or 4 years want quick wins that they can publicize during their campaigns. And in education, in business, you might be able to have a short-time win because you're working usually with raw materials that kids are not raw materials. Every child is unique. So typically business can get short-term wins, short-term results. Politicians want short-term results for political election cycles. You're just not going to get them in health, human services, and social programs and education. It's just not going to happen.
So part of what you have to do, and you were Commissioner of Education in Kentucky for quite a while and have been involved in education for many, many years, it's not just implementing programs, it's convincing people who tend towards short-term thinking that they need to broaden their minds.
Yes, and the other thing is to make sure you do have some ability to track short-term data that lets you know that you can predict you're going to have a long-term impact. Typically, the leadership will say, all right, y'all go do this new reading program. And then a year later, when they don't see any improvement in the state assessment results, they say, well, let's go to this reading program. So every year there's some kind of new program. But what they didn't do, they didn't look at the system of implementation. Did I give them the resources, the training, the support they needed? What happened after the first week? What happened after the first month? What's working? What's not working? What do we need to make a mid-course correction? This, I'm hoping that happens. You know, healthcare, that's the number one place to do it. You know, if I'm in a fairly bad shape and I go in and I do my annual physical and they find some major problem, he doesn't say, take this pill and come back next year. They say, okay, we got a major problem with your kidney function. Let's try this for a month, come back, let's run a blood test. Try this for a month, let's come back, let's send you in for this additional ultrasound. Let's send you in for this MRI. You know, the healthcare has that figured out. Now, their big challenge is how to handle the cost. You know, who's going to pay for all this, and to what degree do you do all this? And waste and the ethics of all of it, you know. But in education, it's very rare we have that type of approach at the classroom level and at the individual student level to say, is what we tried with Johnny working this week? No, we wait till it's too late and Johnny's dropped out.
It's interesting that you're using the healthcare analogy, because if you take it one step further, one of the big keys to healthcare is preventing illness in the first place. So you might not have poor kidney function if you'd had a good diet and exercise or whatever it is that kidneys rely on to be healthy. I don't know anything about kidneys, but the same thing, I mean, again, social factors that stand in kids' ways, preventing those, even though that's not the purview of the school system, it's required. It's necessary.
I think New Mexico legislators get that. I think the investment in early childhood, if we could intervene in those settings where kids have trauma and where they have food deprivation and where they have lack of health care, the earlier you intervene and create that early prevention, you will reap tremendous benefits down the road that the K-3 teachers will not have the tremendous disparity and inequity, because the inequities that you have at the end of 12th grade, they were there at the beginning. They were there in pre-kindergarten. And education closes them a little bit, but they don't close them a lot.
One of the things that has become kind of a truism is that you need a college education if you're going to get a good job. There's a lot of people I know personally, who are absolutely brilliant at mechanics. You know, they're contractors. They know how to build a house. They're really not going to want to be writing a sociology paper. Is there a way to capture that incredible brilliance of that class of people who are very technically minded but are not necessarily going to succeed in college?
The Nation at Risk way back in 83 probably set us up for, you know, warning signals that we were in trouble as a nation due to our education system. Our solution, though, was a little bit one size fits all. Our solution was college for all. And so you saw throughout the 90s, every state adopted more rigorous requirements for high school graduation. If we can just get them through high school, they're going to be okay. But then we got to get them on to college. Everybody's got to go 4 years. The result of that today is very apparent. $1.5 trillion in debt for college education. Pell loan grant defaults, highest in our nation's history. 44 million people owe a common average debt of $35,000, ranging into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Many high school kids who were not prepared for college went on because everybody told them it was the only way to success. They got there and they needed remediation. They stayed for a semester, two semesters, borrowed the money to live on and to go to school. And after a year of that, they're $35,000 in debt and no job, back home living with mom and dad. What we found in Kentucky, a high school grad that didn't go on to post-secondary, was almost the same as a dropout. After 3 years, they were earning less than $10,000 a year. Part-time jobs, no hope for the future. So the key for our next generation is to say, look, there are many ways to success. A four-year degree in English might be nice, but it was your skills, it was your passion, you got a degree, but now what is the job that you're going to get? Well, the young man I'm talking about, the only job he could get was a part-time job in a retail store making minimum wage, no benefits. So he had to go back and get retrained as a college counselor for community college students. And now he's doing very well. What we need to do early on with children is say, what's your passion? If it's the arts, great. I was an artist. If you have the skills to be an artist, great. But now let's take it one step further. What is the economic future? Where are the jobs? Where you need to start in order that you can build toward a job that pays a living wage so that you can support your family and you can support yourself and you can support your community? Too often we're not doing that in our schools. The kids, we just say, you're college material, take Algebra 2. You're not college material, go take plumbing. Wrong. Plumbing is a wonderful career. Many more kids who have skills ought to be in plumbing because they could become their own owner of a plumbing company and make millions of dollars. So there, What we need to do is quit saying there's one blanket size that fits all and everybody needs to go to four-year. We need to say, what is your interest? What are your skills? Where are the jobs? Let's create a pathway that's customized for your future, not our past.
One of the things also when you're talking that I can't help but think about is that those minimum wage jobs are there. They're not going anywhere, and people who have them should be able to live. So part of this systemic thinking is making sure that people who are working full-time in the, you know, low-skill sector can still make a living.
I'm all for a minimum wage, $15 an hour, but what's going to happen as that minimum wage goes up, you'll have a decrease in some of those jobs, and you will have more and more of those jobs become roboticized. There are places now where the entire burger making process is done by robots, and you order from a kiosk and it comes sliding out of a chute. Clothes, same thing. You go in, the computer measures you, then robots make the clothes and it's mailed to you or delivered to you at the end of the store on your way out. So I think the whole world, globalization, computers, technology, they're changing the workforce of the future. They're going to change all that. Many minimum skills, repetitive tasks. Now, the tasks that may not be replaced are things like plumbers and that have to be delivered on site. You're probably not going to fix your sink stop-up by technology online. Somebody might help you figure out how to do it, but if you can't get it done, you're going to need somebody personally to come do it. Now, they might bring a robot that does it, but somebody had to program the robot, somebody had to use the robot, somebody had to be there in case something went wrong with the robot. So the skills of the future are going to require much higher level of skills than minimum wage jobs are currently requiring. Now, no one starts at the job where they're making a living wage. That's rare that happens. Most of them usually start at minimum wage jobs, learn skills, learn teamwork skills, and then transition on into higher paying jobs. So I'm not saying that those jobs are going to go away. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't pay those people a wage that they can at least decently live on. But they're not going to live a middle income type of life at $15 an hour. And they're certainly not going to support a family. So if they want to become contributing members of society, they eventually have to keep moving up.
Right. One thing that I was also thinking about when you were speaking was, you know, this question of what is your passion, and if you really are drawn to English or the arts or the liberal arts, do it, but be cognizant. I'm maybe a little biased on this question because I went to St. John's College, and I mean, that is an education in really learning how to think and learning critical thinking and learning listening and all these things. And people who go to St. John's College are often hired in business because they actually know how to write a memo. They know how to think things through. They know how to analyze, which is something that happens in the liberal arts, which is not direct skills training in business or marketing. It's like a kind of higher level of thought, which is very valuable. And I hate to see that get lost in the conversation on education.
Yeah, we should never lose that. Take a class of 100 high school seniors. Out of that class of 100 high school seniors, you're probably going to have about 25 or 30 in a normal, medium, middle-class income high school. You're going to have about 25 or 30. They're definitely four-year degrees, St. John's. You're going to have about 5 or 6 of them that want Princeton. I'm not saying Princeton's better than St. John's, but just saying, they may want to go to Harvard, that kind of thing. So these kids that already know, they don't know what they want to major in, but they do know they probably want liberal arts, and they will eventually find where they're headed because they really are good thinkers, they're good learners, they're going to be lifelong learners. Nobody wants to do away with that. Everybody wants that, but we ought to at least make sure they know what the potential is for jobs and where they might want to take, what type of critical coursework take to at least start finding an area of interest. Then you're going to have, 25, 30 kids who know, I really want to go 2-year. I got a technical area I'm really interested in. I already know I like HVAC, or I know I like welding, or I know I like this. Then you're going to have about 25 or 30 of these kids who don't have a clue. Those are the kids I'm talking about. Their parents can afford a four-year and an open enrollment. So they go, and the parents are kind of struggling a little bit, so let's borrow the Pell money. We qualify, so let's get the Pell money. And the kids aren't academically prepared, so they get lagged behind, get remediation. Then they drop out because they can't make it, and then there's no job, so they got to go back for retraining or this time. These are the kids I'm really talking about, that we need to figure out something different. And when we tell them that career education is their solution, we're making that a second-class education, same to the parents. And too many of those kids are African-American. Too many of those kids are Hispanic. And too many of those kids, their parents see, you're just dumbing down this stuff for my kid. You're just making the equity gap larger. No. We need to convince these parents the public perception of career pathways is very negative right now. And we need to change the public perception about career education to make it equivalent to St. John's. It's just as good because you said it. You know, people own a construction company. They were good thinkers. They were good with their hands. They figured it out. They went out, went into an apprenticeship, and then eventually got to own their own company. In these 25, 30 kids, there are tons of kids like that. We just got to make school a little different to them. But right now, what we tell them is you got to reach Algebra 2, and they can't do it. They hate school. They're hands-on learners. They're kids who really say, what's the relevance of these courses? What's the relevance of reading Beowulf? And then, of course, you got 10% of the kids who need special education, and those are the kids that you got to customize vocational rehabilitation and training.
I can't help but think that there's probably ways to teach Algebra 2 that would engage those kids that are going to be plumbers.
Absolutely there is, and geometry for construction. But typically our teachers have very little awareness of how you actually use the skills in the workplace.
Yeah. We probably have some teachers, parents, and students listening right now. What would you like to tell them, and how can they be empowered to make most use of the resources that we have and to improve the state of New Mexico?
Well, always the number one thing is be involved in your child's education. I know many parents out there working two or three jobs, but you've got to figure out a way to be involved and stay aware of your child's education and progress. I would encourage students to take better ownership of their own education, to not just wait on the career counselor at the high school to get around to them. I've met many kids who go online, web pages, doing tons of research. I mean, there's so many technology things out there that are free that kids can take advantage of to find their interest and find their passion. I would encourage business and community leaders to be involved, not just go to a dinner. You know, be involved, volunteer, see what's happening with kids. You know,
facilitate apprenticeships.
Work-based learning, if it's just a visit. Just to visit our adopt a kid programs, you know, those kind of things. But if you're going to improve your local community, you got to get engaged, you got to get involved, and you got to stay involved. You just can't show up one time.
Terry Holliday is former Commissioner of Education for the state of Kentucky. He's been visiting New Mexico. I want to thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lano Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.